arm us.
Next time on The World, we'll have the latest from the rocket war. Join us.
Weekday afternoons at 3 on AM 580.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. We begin today with a story we've been following, which is the huge increase in unaccompanied minors, mainly from Central America, who've been crossing the border into the United States. You've seen that the issue is very much on the minds of political leaders. Tens of thousands of kids are expected to make the crossing this year if current trends continue. But this is the kind of story that captures the attention of people from all walks of life and across the political spectrum, because it touches on so many complicated emotions. And we've observed that faith leaders, even more than political leaders sometimes, are the people who learn of a crisis and are called upon to respond in some way, and they are. But how? Some say it's a humanitarian crisis and it is the faith community's obligation to step in. Others are hearing that issues like poverty here at home should be an even bigger priority. We wanted to call upon two faith leaders who are involved in issues of public concern to see how they are responding and what their congregants are telling them. So we've called Pastor Rudy Rasmus. He's senior pastor of St. John's Downtown in Houston, Texas. His congregation is a very active urban ministry, and he's with us from member station KUHF in Houston. Pastor Rasmus, thanks for joining us once again.
Hey, it's good to hear from you today.
And Russell Moore is the president of the Southern Baptist Convention's Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. That is a group that's been very active over the years in matters of public concern, and he joined us from their offices in Nashville. And Mr. Moore, thank you so much for joining us once again.
Great
as well.
Great to be with you today.
So let me start with you, Pastor Rudy Rasmus. You lead a large church in Houston. You're known for, your congregation is known for its active outreach, for example, to the homeless. You're very involved in ministry to that group, for example, in building like a housing center, as I understand it, trying to address homelessness in that issue. I wanted to ask what your congregants are telling you about this issue of these undocumented children coming across. Is this an issue that's on their minds, and what are they saying?
You know, Michelle, this is an issue on their minds, and it's very reminiscent of an event that happened about 10 years ago when a storm came through New Orleans. A lot of people ended up in Houston, Texas, about 300,000 in 48 hours. And this city responded in an amazing way to that particular human crisis. And this crisis is equal to us. I've been asking my congregants over the last couple of weeks. And as a matter of fact, yesterday in service, we lifted up not only a prayer, but a question as to what should our response be in this moment. And I'm hearing some interesting responses, but all of the responses I have heard were coming from the vantage point that we should care.
What do you mean by interesting? Tell me more about that.
You know, it's these are children, and many of the crises that we have faced here in Houston before have been mostly centered around adults. You know, over the last 22 years, the ministry that I'm a part of has provided care to mostly homeless adults, and now here's a crisis with children. And what we do know, an unaccompanied child in this region is prey. Houston is one of the leading cities in this country for sex trafficking and human trafficking, and in that the level of alert goes up another decibel because of the potential harm to really innocent children, regardless to how these children got to the border, regardless to how they ended up in our state and in our city. We do have a moral response.
I'm going to press you on exactly what you think that response should be, or what at least you're thinking about. But I want to hear from Russell Moore. Mr. Moore, thanks for joining us once again. Many people might remember that you, along with another of conservative Christian leaders, have been pressing for immigration reform. For example, you wrote a piece for the Wall Street Journal, an opinion piece with Ralph Reed back in March, where you called upon Congress or the House to pass legislation that reflects conservative values of strong and secure borders, the rule of law, economic opportunity, and strengthening of the family. Basically, pressing conservatives to take a more active role in advancing immigration reform. What are your thoughts about the current crisis and what should happen? And I'm curious about what people are telling you.
Well, I think it's a moral crisis, and I think that what's happening is the awakening of a conscience in this country, because people are seeing images of children. These are children who are in harm's way. They're being, in many cases, crammed into detention facilities. This is a humanitarian crisis. It's a moral crisis. It ought to evoke a conscience that says this is not the way that things ought to be. At the same time, I find that some of the responses that are coming back would love to see an easy, quick fix. And so there are many people in congregations, for instance, when they see these images on television, would say, well, let's just send some mission trips there and fix this crisis. And in reality, until the government comes in and fixes an incoherent policy and also deals with the root problem of people who are fleeing from a drug war going on in Central America, we're not going to be able to get a fix on this.
Does the commission have some guidance for individual congregations at this point about how they should respond or what they should do?
Well, there's a limit on what individual congregations can do, because congregations can't simply show up at the border and start dealing with the refugees that are there, because they're in government holding patterns, waiting for hearings to determine what the refugee status of the children would be. There are groups and Christians and churches who are ministering as best they can. But until the government comes in and takes responsibility for the government's own failed policies here, there's a limit on what we can do. What I've been seeking to do is to speak to our people, to the people of Christ, and to say we need to make sure that we understand that the response to this cannot be what it is in some sectors of American society, which is fear and loathing against immigrants and against refugees. We need to recognize that we have a moral responsibility to love neighbor, and Jesus tells us the story of a man who passes by someone who is beaten on the road, a Samaritan, and he cares for that man. We ought to listen to that message and recognize that our response to this crisis, it can't be a simple and easy fix, but it also can't be to say, well, who is my neighbor in Spanish?
If you're just joining us, we're talking about how faith communities are responding to this huge increase in undocumented children who are crossing the border. I'm speaking with Russell Moore, the president of the Southern Baptist Convention's Ethics and Public Policy Commission, and Pastor Rudy Rasmus of St. John's Downtown in Houston. Those are both prominent faith leaders involved in issues of public concern. So, you know, to that end, you were talking about this whole question of kind of fear and anxiety that this is provoking on the part of some people. I just the video of one Houston resident, a woman named Bernadette Lancelin, went viral last week. She was responding to the Department of Homeland Security officials who were touring an old middle school to see if it could house unaccompanied children. And here she is speaking to the Fox station KRIV.
Now billions of dollars want to be borrowed from the White House to help feed and house them. What about the kids here in our neighborhood, in our country? Don't bring them here. We don't have nothing for them. They're already taken away from my kids. I understand, President Obama, that it is a humanitarian issue. But look right within your own house. Look in your backyard, man.
Pastor Rasmus, I'm sure you've seen this. You're also in Houston. Are you hearing that as
yes.
well?
Well, you know, I understand how scarcity works in the broader context. And In the midst of an impoverished community, that's probably not an unusual response from a person who feels as though their own needs aren't getting met. But we do have to look beyond the our own needs to the needs of these children. You know, when I think about the challenges that these kids must be facing, I'm reminded of also the words of Jesus, who really reminds each of us that the kingdom of God belongs to kids. And when we reflect on the importance of providing a safe place, you know, the government agencies, I believe, will work through the challenges that are facing from a diplomacy standpoint, but in the midst of that, there's still a human need and a victim that is right now standing in the at the crossroads.
Are you preaching on this, and if so, what are you saying?
You know, we're talking about it. When we talk about the needs of those who have a safety concern a lot in our context in our ministry context because of our work in and around the homeless and hungry community in Houston. You know, every week we distribute about 18 tons of food to families, and many of those families I would say are without documentation. But in the midst of that crowd every week, twice a week, I'm finding some incredible human beings who are adding value to the city as well. Mm-hmm. So there's a, our neighbor, when we're responding to our neighbor, the question is always, who is our neighbor? And for me, it's always the person in front of me.
Russell, our final thought from you. What about you? I don't know if you're preaching at the moment, if you're pastoring a congregation, or this kind of is your ministry at the moment. What's your word on this?
Well, I think that the response that some people have is to blame the victim because of fear. This is a fearful situation. It's a situation out of control. But we cannot express rage toward these children who are seeking to escape from very dangerous situations. We ought to be angered by what's happening, but we ought to be angered at the cartels, at the terrorist networks in Central America that are trafficking in drugs and trafficking in human persons. And we also ought to say to our government officials, you have a responsibility given to you by God to maintain public order and justice, and you need to step up and do that.
And what are you going to do?
Well, I plan to work with elected officials to say we need to work on the humanitarian crisis, first of all, and then we need to work on providing a system that's coherent and actually works, and then calling on the people of God to pray and to make sure that our consciences are compassionate and reaching outward toward those in need.
Russell Moore is the president of the Southern Baptist Convention's Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. He joined us from his office in Nashville. Rudy Rasmus is the senior pastor of St. John's Downtown in Houston. He joined us from member station KUHF in Houston. Pastors, thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michelle.
Coming up, it's been a year since a jury found George Zimmerman not guilty in the shooting death of the teenager Trayvon Martin. The decision shocked his parents.
I thought surely that he would be found guilty of second-degree murder, manslaughter at the least.
We'll speak with a diverse panel of columnists who wrote about the issue, about how they reacted to the verdict then and what they think now. That's next on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In post-Katrina New Orleans, tensions over race, class, and politics come to a head in one city council race.
There's a small group of people that attack me largely about race issues. And it's really awkward to have to defend yourself as not a racist, because then you start saying things that are repugnant.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Weekdays starting at noon on AM 580.
On the next POV on WILL-TV, what happens when America's most joyous dysfunctional city rebuilds itself after a disaster? New Orleans is the setting for Getting Back to Normal, a film that serves up a provocative mix of race, corruption, and politics to tell the story of the re-election campaign of Stacey Head, a white woman in a city council seat traditionally held by a black representative. Watch Getting Back to Normal on POV, tonight at 9 on WILL-TV.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We'd like to return now to a story that sparked a great deal of discussion, soul-searching, and emotion last year. A year ago, July 13th, 2013, George Zimmerman was found not guilty of all charges in the 2012 shooting death of the unarmed teenager Trayvon Martin. The verdict sparked protest and intense emotion from many different people, but most especially the family of the teenager, who was shot by the neighborhood watch volunteer while walking home from an errand. Here's Trayvon Martin's mother, Sabrina Fulton, speaking after the verdict.
I thought surely that he would be found guilty of second-degree murder, manslaughter at the least, but I just knew that they would see that this was a teenager just trying to get home. This was no burglar. This was somebody's son that was trying to get home.
President Obama even weighed in on the verdict, saying, quote, Trayvon Martin could have been me 35 years ago. But others thought the trial's outcome was fair and that George Zimmerman was justified under Florida's so-called stand your ground law, which allows the use of deadly force when someone feels they are at risk of bodily harm. A year later, after all this, we wanted to go back to a number of people who offered thoughtful reflections on all the issues raised by the incident to see what else is on their minds. So with us today is Michael Skolnick, editor-in-chief of GlobalGrind.com. He's a Trayvon Martin Foundation board member. Kelly Goff is a columnist for TheRoot.com and The Daily Beast. Neil Minkoff is a healthcare consultant and contributor to National Review Online, a regular contributor to our Barbershop Roundtable. And Leonard Pitts is the Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for the Miami Herald. Welcome to you all. Thank you all so much for joining us once again.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So let us look back at that day a year ago. Michael, I'll start with you because you had spent a lot of time in the courtroom with the family over the course of the trial. And I wanted to ask you to go back to where you were a year ago and what you felt when the verdict came in. And how do you feel today?
Wow. We had decided at the end of the trial that we would not attend the verdict and we all would go home to our respective families and watch it on television, or some of us didn't watch it at all. I'd spent almost the entirety of those 6 weeks in Florida, in Sanford, at the trial with Trayvon's family and friends, and I sat and watched it with my girlfriend in my home in New York. And really, we thought when we went into that deliberation that it was 3-3 and it could have gone either way. We certainly were hoping for a guilty verdict, but knew that it could go either way. And when it came down, I sat for hours sort of motionless, thinking that the decision of six people have such a great impact on the history of our country. If that decision went a different way, one could imagine where we could be today in terms of our conversations about race, in terms of our conversations about justice for young black men. A year later, I want to see more light and less tunnel in this case and in life. So I think I want to be optimistic that Trayvon's parents, Sabrina and Tracy, even for the past year, have continued to lead the case for justice, not just for their son, but for so many children, with incredible dignity and humility and compassion. And I believe in them, and I believe that they will heal the wounds from that night, and I believe that they will heal the wounds from so many things that plague this nation in terms of race. So I'm putting my energy into them and putting my faith into their work.
Leonard Pitts, what about you?
What did I feel? An all too familiar sense of betrayal, I think would be the best way to put it. What I felt was that we have sort of traveled in a circle to something that we've seen all too often, which is the justice system, or as I call it frequently in my column, the injustice system, failing to acknowledge and protect the humanity and the basic human rights of African-American men, specifically because they are African-American men. I think it's a mistake to look at the Trayvon Martin verdict in isolation. I think if you look at the Trayvon Martin verdict in context of American history, you see a pattern that is undeniable. And the only thing that's surprising, if you want to say it about this verdict, is that we're still dealing with this all of these years later. But this is not the first time and not the first way in which the justice system has failed African-American young people. I continue to rail about the war on drugs, which has in fact been waged as a war on African-American men, even though African-American men are, I believe, 15% of drug crime and or drug use in this country. In some jurisdictions, they account for 90% of people doing drug time. There's something wrong with that picture. And again, Trayvon Martin is a piece of the puzzle, but there's a much larger picture here. And I would hope that if anything, as we look back on this, we take this as an occasion not just to deal with that injustice that happened to that family, but this larger picture of which that's just a piece.
Kelly Goff, what about you?
Well, for me, it's not just so much about the whether or not the verdict was just, but the law itself being unjust. And that's really a year later what I'm sort of focused on, is seeing what we can continue to do in terms of these stand your ground laws. I'm also someone, as you probably know by now, Michelle, who tries to find the light at the end of the tunnel, or the sort of common ground that all of us as Americans can grow from whenever there's a tragedy or something that seems to divide us. And for me, one of the at least positive outcomes from this severe tragedy is the fact that I found myself having conversations about racial profiling with friends I've had for years who were white, who I never had had that conversation with before. You know, I had friends who I was telling my own stories of racial profiling in stores who said, I can't believe that would happen to you. And so to have me have those conversations, the president finally have that conversation about it happening to him, it's sort of, I know this is a bit of a stretch, but if you'll just bear with me in the analogy, mm-hmm. in the same way that Emmett Till sort of forced a conversation about civil rights and segregation, which a lot of people said, it's not that bad, right? I think that Trayvon Martin did the same in terms of racial profiling in this country, going from not being that bad or a minor inconvenience to being something that can be a matter of life or death.
Neil Minkoff, what about you?
So I think I'm struck by the fact that I don't think it's had as much of an impact as one might have thought ahead of time. As much discussion as there been, I don't know of any state where the duty to retreat or stand your ground laws have been changed. And then you have someone as high profile as Mark Cuban recently saying that he would rather cross the street than come across a young African-American man in a hoodie. So the thing that to me is most striking is that for all of the attention that this case had, a year later, it feels like much of it has receded into the darkness and that there isn't as much progress or as much discussion as one might have expected.
Leonard Pitts, you voiced a sense of disappointment. In fact, it's interesting that our panel here today is kind of half of the group feels kind of optimistic that there is some kind of light at the end of the tunnel. There's some positive things that have come out of it. Half of our panel feels less that. You're of the disappointed and kind of less that side of the equation. Is there anything that you feel would have made a difference or that could make a difference now so that we're not having this conversation 5 years from now?
I think that the problem at its root is an unwillingness of this nation to have the conversation. I think that you can put it literally right in somebody's face, and if they have a vested and emotional interest in not seeing, then they will not see. As we've been talking for the last few minutes about, you know, that we're having more, we've had more conversations. I think that's true in one sense, but in the other sense, what is the point of having a conversation if half of us, or better than half, are not listening? Or are not or are refusing to listen? And I think that's, you know, that's what the Trayvon Martin verdict tells me.
Is this a leadership issue? Because I know I'm going to go to Kelly Goff in a minute, because part of the reason is that Kelly was critical of the president. At one point, she wrote that she felt it was unconscionable that there was no mention of race in the statement that the White House put out immediately following the verdict. Now, so Leonard Pitts, I'm going to ask you first, and then I'm going to go to Kelly on this. Was this a leadership issue? And if it's a leadership fail, and if so, whose leadership fail?
I'm not much into the whole idea. You know, Gil Scott-Heron had a song about waiting on the train from Washington. It's 100 years overdue, so stop waiting for it. You know, I'm not much for the whole idea of who's going to be our leader from Barack Obama on down. And that's not to say that he has not been unconscionably silent on occasions when perhaps he should have spoken up on matters of race. But by the same token, I understand and have understood for the last 6 years or so that he is constrained by politics and by the uniqueness of his own situation. You know, we people of conscience, we people who see what's going on here, we need to be about setting the agenda, and we need to be about moving to make the structural changes and the perceptual changes in this country that make something like this unthinkable 5 years from now.
Kelly Goff, what do you think would make a difference, would have made a difference, would make a difference now in feeling that there was more progress as a result of this terrible tragedy?
Well, definitely if there's something happened in terms of the stand your ground laws, and we saw real movement on those, and we haven't as of yet, Michelle. And I mean, I don't have to bore everyone with the statistics, but, you know, I mean, they're out there. The one that shows that, you know, a white person is, was it 354% more likely to be acquitted or to stand your ground to be seen as a viable defense if the person they shot is black versus if it's a white person shooting a white person. So, you know, we're not a year after the verdict. I think no one who opposes stand your ground laws or thinks that they're flawed is happy with where we're at right now. I'm certainly not.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the impact of the Trayvon Martin case a year after George Zimmerman's acquittal. We're speaking about this with Kelly Goff, Michael Skolnick, Neil Minkoff, and Leonard Pitts. Michael Skolnick, what about you?
I don't think we're at a tipping point, but I think we're certainly pushing towards it. You know, we talk about stand your ground laws. Yes, we haven't overturned a stand your ground law, but let us remember, up until 2012, when Trayvon Martin was killed, we had 25 states pass stand your ground laws with no questions asked. We have not had one state since pass a new stand your ground law. That is successful, and that is young people who took to the streets, who took to social media, who took to legislative, you know, houses and said, no more. At least if we can't get them off the books, let's not put a new one on the books. And I agree agree with Leonard. I don't think it's happened yet, but it is happening. And young folks, we wouldn't be talking about Trayvon Martin if it wasn't for young people who demanded an arrest in those first 45 days after Trayvon Martin was killed. I don't want to be stupidly optimistic, but I want to at least say that there is things happening in this country that are good. I want to keep fighting for those young people. I believe in them, and I believe they will make this country better.
Now, Minka, from a conservative perspective, does something need to be different? And if so, what? And if so, who needs to be leading that? How should that be? Who should be in charge of that?
Sure. I mean, I think that one of the things that we're seeing here in terms of potential lack of impact is this ADD, attention deficit disorder, that's been brought about to the nation by the perpetual cable news cycle. So a lot of the people who had very, very strong feelings about Zimmerman versus the Zimmerman case and the Trayvon Martin shooting have been, their passions have been taken up by Malaysian jets or Hobby Lobby decisions or border crises, and it's hard to focus on any one issue given the fact that the headlines change and the screaming and the shouting about the headlines change. I mean, the irony is that the person who's probably done the most to keep George Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin in the headlines is George Zimmerman, by being a celebrity boxer and by showing up at gun shows and by having the police called upon him repeatedly. So I think that one of the things that has to change is, if we're going to be serious about changes, if we're going to be serious about the need for an example like this to be brought forward, is that it's not enough to say that only 1% of the population or 5% or a few people who are truly committed should care a week after it's faded out of the headlines and move on to the next scandal.
So let me ask each of you to conclude this. What would you like to see happen now? Leonard Pitts, I'll start with you, because you wrote a piece after the verdict directed really at Black America, I think, fair to say,
yeah.
Saying, you know, wake the hell up. We are living, I'm quoting here, we are living in a perilous era for African-American freedom. The parallels to other eras have become too stark to ignore. What are you urging people to do?
The dance of African-American history has always been two steps forward, one step back. And we are now in a period of one step back with Trayvon Martin, obviously, with the gutting of the Voting Rights Act, et cetera, et cetera. I think that it is incumbent upon African Americans to divorce themselves from the ADD that we were just talking about, and to organize and to commit themselves to ourselves to a program of changing some of these things, a program of using whatever pressure we can bring to bear to roll back these stand your ground laws, but also to do whatever we can to change the whole, I keep coming back to this, the whole perception of African-American men.
Michael Skolnick, you're kind of a person who's an activist as well as a columnist, very, very involved with social media. What's your charge here? What do you think should happen now?
I want to uplift the words of Leonard Pitts on the war on drugs. I think there are two very specific things we can do now. If we look at, you know, why young men of color profiled and the criminalization of young Black youth, I completely agree with Leonard that the war on drugs was an absolute war against Black and brown America, and that has to come to an end. And we have a piece of legislation in the Senate called the Smarter Sentencing Act, which would end mandatory minimums on drug crimes. We should fight for that to get to the floor and get a vote. There's an incredible proposition in California on the ballot this year, Proposition 47, which reclassifies five felonies, a simple drug possession, into misdemeanors, could bring home 20,000 people, mostly Black and Latino men, from prison immediately and change the records of over a million people to reclassify their former felonies as misdemeanors. So those are two things that I think we can do now. Proposition 47 in California and the Smarter Sentencing Act in the Senate needs to come to a vote.
Neil Minkoff, what do you want to see happen? What's your charge, if I could call it
so
that?
Sure, I know you're not going to believe this, but I completely agree with Michael on this, which is we need to get out of the situation where crimes such as the ones that have been he mentioned, especially around the war on drugs, do not ruin a young person's life and push them to becoming potentially, give them the opportunity to not become a criminal, so that they have the ability to start afresh and not be besmirched or have their life ruined by a meaningless charge at an early stage. I think that's a wonderful example of something that we could do immediately that would be of lasting effect.
Kelly Goff?
Well, one of the most important things, and I'm not trying to be glib here, is vote. And I don't just mean in the presidential elections. These stand your ground laws would not be on the books in most states if people actually showed up in local elections, and particularly young people are less likely to do so. All voters are less likely to do so, but particularly young people. So we have to impress upon people the importance of voting for all those offices that you think don't matter and you've never heard of, because they do, and that's how these types of laws get on the books. And the last thing I'm going to say, Michelle, it sounds like a small one, but it's not, is I've never met a person who hasn't tried to get out of jury duty. And the wake-up call for me with the Zimmerman verdict was, I've been one of those people, I'm too busy, I have a new job, I can't take time off, I have a trip planned. And I got called for jury duty a couple months after that verdict, and I served, and I was proud to do so. And I remember I went on Facebook and said, I've never been prouder to show up, and I think this should be a wake-up call for all of us, that we should all wear showing serving on a jury as a badge of honor, because it can make a difference.
Kelly Goff is a columnist for TheRoot.com and The Daily Beast. She was with us from our bureau in New York, along with Michael Skolnick, who's editor-in-chief of GlobalGrind.com and a board member of the Trayvon Martin Foundation. Neil Minkoff is a healthcare consultant and contributor to National Review Online. He was with us from Boston. And Leonard Pitts is a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist with the Miami Herald, the author of a number of books. He was here with us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Thank you all so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, after a diagnosis of breast cancer, Grammy-winning country star Sheryl Crow's personal life became public in a whole new way.
I got a glimpse into how crazy and how sensational the whole media thing can be, in that I had photographers camping outside of my door wanting to get pictures of me at my lowest.
She talks about getting through that, plus playing rock and roll with two kids in tow. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Walton Family Foundation, whose K-12 initiative works to empower families with quality school choices. WaltonK12.org. From the Gruber Family Foundation, to help extend the depth of international coverage of the world's most significant issues. From the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives. On the web at Hewlett.org. And from Joyce V. Hale, in the interest of engaging an informed and civil electorate. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, globalization and the decline of American manufacturing. We talk with journalist Beth Macy about how the American furniture industry collapsed in the face of cheaper, subsidized Chinese products, and how one American factory owner fought to keep his business and employees afloat. Her new book is called Factory Man. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Today's programming is made possible in part by the Friends of WILL and by Country Financial Representative Scott Jackson, Village at the Crossing in Champaign, committed to helping clients achieve financial security through effective planning. Online at scottjacksonfinancial.com.
Tonight at 7 on the Evening Concert on WILL FM 90.9. It's the Festival for Early Music Cologne on the Deutsche Welle Festival Concerts. You'll hear excerpts from one of the earliest examples of English opera, Purcell's Dido and Aeneas. Also on the program, works by Byrd, Tallis, Dowland, and other composers of the era. That's the Festival for Early Music Cologne, tonight at 7 on the Evening Concert, on WILL FM 90.9.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. As we head toward production of our final program on August 1st, we've been bringing you encores of some of our favorite conversations. Today, we're hearing again from Grammy-winning recording artist Sheryl Crow. She's been a rock star for more than a decade. Her breakthrough came in 1993 with her debut album, Tuesday Night Music Club, and the monster hit, All I Want to Do. Well, 7 albums and 9 Grammys later, she's got a new concert video out featuring the late Johnny Cash.
It's a train, that's heaven's gate, to heaven's gate, to heaven's gate.
Sheryl Crow stopped by our New York bureau in 2010 to talk with us about her album 100 Miles from Memphis, and I started by asking her about the soul influences on the record.
Interestingly enough, I grew up in a really small town, 106 miles from Memphis, and when I was growing up, the music that we always listened to came out of Memphis, came out of Memphis radio stations, and a lot of that was informed by the music that was born of Memphis. People like Al Green and Otis Redding and all the music that was made at High Records and Stax. So when I first started singing, when I moved to L.A., what I was doing was, you know, basically soul music and really could not get arrested by a record label. I got turned in by everybody. So I just felt like it was really time to get back to doing to making a record that was solidly committed to my earliest influences.
And speaking of earliest influences, I have to play a little bit from the bonus track. And I have to tell you that when I got the CD, I just popped it in. And when I got to this one, I can't express the feeling of joy that came over me.
Oh, that's so great. That's what you want, right?
Right. But I'm just going to play it. I'm not going to tell people what it is. I'm just going to play it. Here it is. I'm 12 years old again. Love it. What made you do the Jackson 5?
Well, it was just a kind of a happy accident. We recorded quite a few covers on this record, and one of them was an unreleased track, which actually you can now get on iTunes, by Marvin Gaye, called Desperate Situation. And the rhythm track was really, really similar. And at the end of it, I just started singing I Want You Back over it. And we wound up recording the whole song, and the band really fought hard for me to put it on the record because, you know, in some ways, it was really a celebration for me of how I got my start. I got my start as a backup singer for Michael Jackson. The first record I ever owned that Santa Claus brought me was ABC, and it was also the year anniversary of his death. So things just kind of lined up for that to work out. And I contend people say, wow, you sound just like him.
I do have to ask about that experience singing backup for Michael Jackson on the tour for the album. What was that like, and what do you think you learned from that?
It was everything. You know, I've told a lot of people the fact that I didn't even own a passport. I mean, I had basically been a school teacher up until 6 months before I got that gig. And I moved to L.A. I was doing some backup work. I heard some singers talking about a closed audition, and I crashed it, and I wound up getting it. And the next thing I know, a month later, I'm singing with, arguably the biggest artist to ever come along, and probably who will ever come along. It was very surreal, but at the same time, when I look back on it, and granted it was 20 years ago, I can't believe how blessed I was to actually get to witness Michael Jackson in his brilliance, you know, his divinity. And and not many people have that memory of standing on the side of the stage in the dark and getting to double him on She Says I Am the One, and getting to sing with him and getting to watch him do these moves that no one had ever seen before him, and that now, of course, we take for granted. And, you know, I think his death really caused everybody, you know, collectively to sort of reflect for a moment about who we are, you know, because it's really easy to invest in the tabloid fodder that goes along with someone who is really ultimately at the core just a human being, a very fragile human being. And no one will ever really know the truth about what went on in Michael's private life. But the real fact is that he grew up with a very unnatural upbringing. And I think it reflected to us something about our level of compassion. And our level of compassion in everyday life of really investing in other people's lives and their misfortunes and so on and so forth. I would safely say that I've been relatively untouched by my success because I got a late start. I wasn't successful at the age of five with people trying to get at me and surrounding my limousine. And my situation was much, much different. And I can safely say that I enjoy a certain amount of anonymity that he could never ever enjoy.
Except that whatever happens in your life still plays out publicly. I do take your point that, you know, he could not go out on the street. But getting back to you, when you experience something as personal and as profound as breast cancer, for example, mm-hmm. you know, it doesn't take place sort of privately. I would like to ask if you don't mind my invading your space a little bit to talk
sure.
about how you think that experience changed you as an artist.
For me, once I was handed that diagnosis, it was very apparent to me that my life was never going to look or feel the same to me again. And that my lesson was in my diagnosis of and laying on the radiation table every single morning for 7 weeks was nobody can take care of me but me. And I wasn't doing that. I was putting everybody's needs before me. And so it was really, you know, I met myself on that radiation table every day. And I had to reflect and had to remember who it was I came in as and had to really sort of redefine my life. And the thing that I would say in addressing the whole fame thing was that I got a glimpse into how crazy and how sensational the whole media thing can be, in that I had photographers camping outside of my door wanting to get pictures of me at my lowest, you know, having been through a public breakup and then having been diagnosed. And I have been able to make choices now in my life that choices that have made my career smaller but have given me a life that I can enjoy more.
Well, let me apologize on behalf of my colleagues for your the collective apology on behalf of
well,
my
no,
colleagues.
Well, no, this is quite different. I mean, it's wonderful to be able to go – I mean, doing radio is wonderful because I had a conversation with somebody earlier who does print, and he asked me something that was completely – he said, I would just want to clarify something, and it was something that was really ugly that I had supposedly said. And it's wonderful to be able to go out and speak and have people actually hear firsthand – you know, what it is you're about and get an idea of who you are. And I think there's great merit to that. So it's great to have the opportunity to use my voice and get to speak with someone who does intelligent interviewing. And I actually listen to your show. So
well, thank you.
My poor kids are growing up with not getting to hear Lady Gaga, but instead are listening to NPR.
We have a little Lady Gaga on there from time to time. We
oh, that's good. That's good. My 3-year-old is very into Lady Gaga.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Our guest is multi-platinum Grammy Award-winning artist Sheryl Crow. We're talking about her new album, 100 Miles from Memphis, and, you know, a lot of other stuff that occurs to us. How are your kids? And that is also a big life change, isn't it, as an artist, having two young children?
Oh, my gosh. As a person, it's a real game changer. And it's great, and I love every minute of it. And we are a traveling circus now. We are like the Cirque du Soleil of pop rock, I guess. We have the blow-up pool and the little bicycle and all of his books and all the dinosaurs and the bottle warmers and the diapers and all the drug, sex, and rock and roll. All that mythology just flies right out the window when you come on my bus. It's, you know, it's really a trip. But it's been a joy. And it's really, for me, artistically, it's made it a very wonderfully provocative time to be a writer.
Well, give me an example.
Well, you know, the last record was really an interesting record to make because I'd gone through the breast cancer thing and the public breakup and adopted a child and had not really sat down to write anything, and consciously so, because I didn't want to go to music to sort of bury the emotion of it all. I really wanted to experience it in order to be done with it.
But are you saying that sometimes if you write about something too soon, it's almost like you're performing yourself, it's not authentic? Unless – you know what I mean? I'm trying to understand how that –
I think emotionally it's really authentic. I think for me, when you go to your work, it sort of fortifies that belief system that we Westerners have, which is, oh, I know you're going through a hard time. Just try to stay busy. Try not to think about it. And ultimately, the real learning and the real growth comes from experiencing our emotions. You know, that's where the awakening really occurs. I remember reading an interview with Dana Reeves, and I really had a lot of respect for her. That when Christopher Reeves died, somebody asked her, how do you get through the grief? And she said, you grieve. You know, the only way to get through it is you grieve it. You experience it. And with me, you know, with losing the relationship that I had and what was family for me, and then getting diagnosed 6 days later. If I'd gone to music and I had made my music about making it feel okay, I think I would have really missed out on what was important for me, which was learning how to be sad and to be scared and to be angry and all those things, which ultimately made me stronger and made me more equipped to move forward and be a real active participant in the emotional aspects of my life.
Oh, tell me about the urgency. That's where I interrupted you. You're saying that something about being a mom has made you feel even more urgent about what you're trying to do.
Well, having a three-month-old and sitting down to write and having been on the, on the global warming tour and watching what was happening with, our government at the time really denying the IPCC reports and feeling like, what is it going to take for us to really wise up and understand that no matter what the science says, we share this planet. We can't be that selfish to think that I'm gonna get out of what I can living my life and not care about my neighbor or the people that come after me or my kids or whatever. It's like the idea of leaving the campground in a better space than how you found it. It's just – it's about being a conscious person and not having it be a political stance. And compound that with we had just gotten into a war that was, to me, unfounded and was based on lies. And so there were all these things that I felt like were a direct reflection of who we were. And it felt personal for me with having a three-month-old. It felt like, wow, who are we becoming? And when we choose people to represent us, we really need to look at that, what that person, what aspects of ourselves that leader represents in us. And to have a little one looking at you 24 hours a day to be the truth for that little person, it just made me feel differently about writing and about who I was and who I wanted to be.
That was Sheryl Crow talking about her album 100 Miles from Memphis. Finally, today it's time for the feature we call In Your Ear. Throughout our years on the air, we've been asking some of our guests to share the music that inspires them. And in our final weeks on the air, we thought it would be nice to hear about the songs members of our staff are listening to. Editor Tanya Ballard-Brown advises us on all things digital, but we wanted to hear what's on her playlist.
I'm Tanya Ballard-Brown, an editor with NPR.org, and this is what's playing in my ear. Whenever I hear the opening beats of I Know You Know by Esperanza Spalding, I feel like that is my theme song because it's so kind of funky.
The way you look at me when you think I'm not looking tells me your heart's a sleeping giant wanna buy someone you loved before me. I see you're scared, unconvinced by what I've tried to say.
And I envision myself like entering a room and this music is playing and the door is flung open and everyone looks up, because I'm dramatic like that. So I Know You Know, the very beginning of it, Esperanza Spalding, she did it with that song.
In this world, there's much confusion. And I taste the city life and it's not for me.
When I hear Destiny by the Jacksons, I've loved this song since I was a kid. I was introduced to it by my cousin Chris, who is just a little bit older than me, and he used to drill me like Joe Jackson on all the Jackson songs. And I had to know who was playing what instrument. I had to know every hee-hee.
Let me be me. Come on, let me feel free.
Every beat, every song, every note. And this particular song, I don't know, it spoke to me even then because it was so soulful. And I, at the time, was growing in my Michael Jackson fandom. I hadn't flowered completely as I have now.
Gonna search this world until I find my destiny. If it's the rich life, I don't want it. Happiness ain't always material things.
Michael sings this song about You know, if it's the rich life, I don't want it. Happiness ain't always material things. And that has stuck with me for a long time. It always, whenever he had his troubles, that song would pop into my mind about, you know, is this really the life that he had intended for himself? And destiny sort of pops into my mind. And I also think a lot about my destiny and what I am meant to do and meant to be.
How like a fall to be gone in a day, just as the leaves had turned gold. I was drawn to a sound that the wind carried down from an open window pane. And oh,
Deenda by Sting is just a beautiful song that reminds me of a really happy and a little bit sad time in my life. And I hope that everyone else loves it as much as I do.
And the harmony rings with the promise of spring on a Brooklyn street.
That was Tell Me More editor Tanya Ballard Brown telling us what's playing in her ear. That's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.
Let the harmony ring with the promise of